This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 1 year since Mario Cuomo was voted out of office. He'd served as New York State governor since 1983. Many Democrats assumed that when he left the governor's mansion, it would be to move higher up in politics. He became a rising star of the Democratic Party after he gave the keynote address at the 1984 Democratic Convention. He anguished over entering the 92 presidential campaign and decided against it. At that year's Democratic Convention, he gave Clinton's nominating address. He later declined a position on the Supreme Court. Since leaving the governor's mansion, Cuomo has joined a law firm, started a syndicated weekly radio program, and written a book. His new book, Reason to Believe, is a critique of the Republican contract with America. Cuomo's successor, Governor Pataki, reinstituted capital punishment shortly after taking office. I asked Cuomo, a staunch opponent of capital punishment, what his gut reaction was.
Two reactions to it. One of them was gut, and the other was my mind. My gut was prepared. I knew what they were going to do. My mind tells me that it was a very dangerous signal that we received when, at the inauguration of the new governor, when he began his inaugural address, and I heard the first few paragraphs, and as a person who had the experience myself more than once, I thought, this is a pretty good speech. But I kept listening, and he didn't reach any high notes. He didn't really have the audience thrilled by anything he said. And then he got to the sentence where he referred to bringing back the death penalty, and the audience exploded in exultation. And they were on their feet, and they were cheering, and they were whistling, and they were clapping. And I said, oh, my goodness. To be satisfied, to be pleased in this reaffirmation that we, the people, had gotten what we wanted, 80% of us voting for the death penalty, that's fine, that's understandable. But exultation, joy at knowing that you'll be able to execute people again, knowing that occasionally one of them will be found to have been innocent after all, knowing that it is, at the very least, an implicit statement by you, the government of this grand state, that brutality can be acceptable under some circumstances. Cheering that, smiling, laughing, slapping one another on the back, that was a little tough to take. So my reaction then, intellectually, was this is a more troublesome and troubling time than I thought. And I thought I understood it.
There's an old saying that's become kind of a cliche by now, that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. Now, I know that at least two people in your family have been mugged. Both your wife and your daughter had been mugged, I think, in the 1980s, maybe the 70s. Did that affect your views on crime at all? Did you go through a period of being so shaken by that that you rethought how to deal with crime?
No. Each time that my family has experienced violence, I have been reconfirmed in my attitude toward the death penalty and punishment generally. Matilda and Christopher, our youngest, were mugged. Our home was broken into while we were in the bedroom, and I slept every night after that with a 36-inch Louisville Slugger next to the bed, believe it or not. A Louisville Slugger is a very big bat if it's a 36-inch bat. But on two occasions, one of my daughters was attacked by the same man, accosted, touched, molested. And the second time, he left a mark on her breast with his cigarette. And we never found him, although we looked for a long time, and she did mug shots and thought she was able to identify him. And all those experiences drew the same reaction from me, a terrible anger, kind of anger that made me believe that the greatest blessing was we never found the man, that I wasn't there when the mugging occurred because I might have gotten killed or the mugger might have gotten killed, that I was capable of using all of what was then my considerable physical strength to hurt whoever was hurting my daughter or threatening to hurt my family, that I might even kill them. unless restrained. And I felt that each time. I feel that almost just thinking about it. And I know that that's wrong. And experiencing it reminds me that it is a natural impulse which we ought not to encourage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mario Cuomo, and the occasion for his visit is a new book called Reason to Believe. Do you see yourself running again for office at some time in the future?
I wouldn't rule it out, only because my life has been a series of improbabilities. You know, all the good things that happened in my life were things I never would have expected, never thought I deserved. Matilda being the first of them. You know, if you had said to me, hey, Mario, you're gonna get the most beautiful woman available, the smartest, the best mother, and the best friend, and she's going to stay with you for 41 years, although you're a terrible pain in the neck increasingly over that entire period. I'd say, well, that can't happen. And the governorship before that would have been improbable, and three terms surely would have been impossible, and an invitation to the Supreme Court is a fantasy and an illusion. So I'm beyond saying no to anything. You know, I'm at a stage where I'm grateful for everything and open to any possibility, good or bad. No, I wouldn't rule out politics. I love the public life.
You are, I think, widely regarded as among the most eloquent speechmakers today. And you've said that you usually write your own speeches, or at least write most of it, that in fact you have trouble delivering a speech that was written for you, a major speech, it just doesn't work for you. Why not? How often did you try it?
I never actually read a speech written for me, but I will tell you that in the beginning of my career, before I was in public life, I represented authors, and I knew people very
well. As a lawyer,
Jimmy Breslin was a friend of mine. Adam Walensky, who was a genius who worked for Robert Kennedy, a real genius. And all of these people at one time or another wrote things. Steve Schlesinger, who is a friend of mine still, who is an author himself and the son of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., another brilliant person. All of these people wrote things for me. They write much better than I do, but they don't write in my cadences. They don't write in my words. They don't feel what I feel.
So were you ever at a podium reading one of their speeches,
no,
realizing this isn't going to work for me?
No, but I read them before I went to the podium and said, I can't read these words, as some of the words were much better than any words I could contrive. And that by itself, would have been a giveaway. I don't speak this way. I don't write this way. You know, you guys do, your prose. In the end, it's a lot easier to use your own words, even if you don't write as well. And, you know, this is an interesting thing. You'll get people who will come and say, I'd like to write speeches for you. And you do use speechwriters if you're a governor, because no matter how much you want to write for yourself, I write all the stuff you'll ever hear. But every day you may have two or three or four stops where you have to talk to this group or that group, you know, on this subject or that subject. And what you normally do is you have cards written for you, and you go and you read from the podium about the award being presented to this osteopath for the wonderful thing he did.
Mm-hmm.
So you do need to, and there are people who write letters for you or things like that. And what will happen is some of the best writers will try to write something for you, and it's not as good as the memorandum they dashed off last night. Why? Because they attempt to emulate your cadences, your style, and that distorts everything they do. So it's very tough to find a Peggy Noonan who suits Reagan so perfectly. I mean, either Reagan became Noonan or Noonan became Reagan. I don't know how it worked out, but, you know, that was a match made in heaven, and it worked. But those are very rare.
My guest is Mario Cuomo. He's written a new book called Reason to Believe. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo. What did you do to prepare your address, your keynote address at the Democratic Convention in 84?
I didn't want to do the keynote. Timmy Russett worked for me at the time. Tim Russett, who is now a big, big star, and he was my director of communications. My son Andrew was in the administration. He had been my campaign manager, and The two of them knew that Mondale had asked me to do the keynote, and they asked what I thought, and I said, I don't want to do it. I'm not good enough. Nobody knows me in the country. I've only won one election. It's not good for Fritz. I want Mondale to win, and he needs a heavyweight. We should get Ted Kennedy. Kennedy was not supporting Mondale yet before the convention. I went to see Kennedy. It was the only time I'd ever seen him. I was with him until 3 o'clock in the morning. I called Mondale the next day. I was delighted. I said, I think I can get Ted Kennedy to endorse you and to endorse you big time, but he has to be the keynote speaker at the convention. Mondale didn't like that idea at all. He said, I don't want Ted Kennedy. I want you. I said, nobody knows me. I made a big argument. And he got irritated, Mondale. He said, look, you said you would do anything that you could to have me win. I said, that's right. He said, well, this is what I'm telling you I need. So I went to Russet and Andrew, and I told them, and I said, this is awful. So now I had to sit down to write a speech, and I was negative about the proposition. I took my inaugural address and tried to refashion it as a speech. I spent 3 nights by myself. Writing, not days, nights. In the days I did my work, and at nights I wrote. Then I brought in Tim Russet and Andrew, and Tim Russet changed one paragraph and said, put this paragraph at the top. Andrew said, add some stuff about your mama and papa. That's my mama and papa. I said, no, people don't want to hear about mama and papa. He says, yes, yes, you have to do that. That's important. And that's what we did. I wrote the speech. I was very dissatisfied with it. We went to San Francisco. Andrew and I put it on the teleprompter the day before we had to give the speech. I went maybe one quarter through the teleprompter reading, and it was awful. We killed the teleprompter, said, forget about it. I went out, played a softball game with Brokaw, Jennings, and a few of the other people. Hit a double, incidentally.
Yes.
then gave the speech the next day, and it was very well received.
So had you rewritten it in the interim, or what?
I had written it, rewritten it, but I never liked it. What I did do with that speech that one should do with every speech they ever give if you have the time, I read it to about 15 or 20 people in my office in New York City, including some elevator operators, secretaries, a cleaning woman who I'd asked specifically to come in. I had had some talks with her at night. And she was a very interesting person. I came as close as I could to a kind of American audience that you might get lucky with on television. And I read the thing, and then I just asked them to give me quick reactions. And one said, sounds too liberal. One says, you didn't mention this. One says, I took all those reactions, rewrote the speech, went to Albany, and read it to some people in Albany. Whole speech. I put them in a room and read the whole thing and got some reactions from them. These were kind of polls, surveys, focus groups, and then used all of their remarks to rewrite it. On the plane going there, Jimmy Breslin, I went, I guess the day before, Jimmy Breslin came and sat next to me. And he said, may I read your speech? I said, no, Jimmy, because if you read it, you're going to see that it's not as good as it could be. You're going to make suggestions. I'm going to get all filed up. He said, I promise I won't. I gave him the speech. He took out his pencil. I pulled the pencil out of his hand. And he said, I can't read it without the pencil. So I gave him the pencil back. He read it, but I wouldn't let, this is the truth, I wouldn't let him make any marks, okay? He finishes the speech. He hands it to me. He says, this is going to be a knockout. I said, Jimmy, you don't know what you're talking about. I said, that's what you should stay writing columns, writing books. Just leave the politician's job to me. I said, you did a lousy job when you were a candidate, and, you know, you should stay out of the business. And Breslin says, no, this will be a knockout. And it was much, much better received than I thought. Was it well prepared? No. Was it well written? I do not believe it was well written. Was it well delivered? Not really. Baltimore Sun just did a piece on my book that's overall very complimentary, but they talk about the 84 convention speech, and they said there was nothing imposing about the speaker or the delivery of the speech, and I think he was right. The reason it worked so well, the things I said in the speech, the people were feeling at the moment.
Well, the conceit of the speech was a tale of two cities, and you were comparing the Reagan image of a shining city on a hill with what you perceived as the reality of cities in America, where there were a lot of people who were poor and struggling and lacking in education and so on. Tell me how you came up with that conceit.
During the writing of the speech, someone gave me an article involving the city on the hill. I'm vague on this, and Reagan's reference to the city on a hill and the history of the idea of the city on a hill. And the rest was easy. That, incidentally, was not the only metaphor in the speech, and that was one of the problems with the speeches. There were a couple of metaphors, like the wagon train, which I preferred. You know, the wagon train goes west, discharging people along the way. We believe there's room in the wagon for everybody. Or the table, Rabbi Hillel and Francis of Assisi and crumbs from the table. There's room for the table for everybody. I mean, so there were a lot of metaphors. It was not an excellent speech as written. It was not an excellent speech as delivered. I repeat, the reason it got the reaction it did, and it did bring people to tears. It almost brought me to tears. And the reason Walter Cronkite and Brinkley said extravagant things about it was because of the reaction to the speech. And that reaction was triggered by the fact that what I was saying, people were feeling. I didn't lift them to a new level. I didn't introduce them to a truth that hadn't occurred to them. I had them look into their own hearts. And when I said to them, look, wouldn't it be better to be the family of America sharing one another's benefits and burdens? People understood that. They wanted to hear it. They liked the idea that we could love one another intelligently and with good results. Incidentally, I don't believe you could give that speech today.
Why not?
And get the same result. Because I don't believe people feel that way this moment.
They feel how instead?
I said after the Reagan years that Ronald Reagan, who as an individual is a marvelous human being and benign and sweet and compassionate and charming, but his worst legacy was that he made the denial of compassion respectable. He made America feel that, hey, look, there's no point in wondering whether you can save the poor. You can't. Wondering whether you can do more to put the unemployed to work. You can't. Wondering whether you should struggle harder to find shelter for the homeless. They don't want it. Don't feel guilty. You've done more than you should do. They're on their own now, and you shouldn't be troubled by it.
One of your now famous speeches was delivered at Notre Dame University in 1984, and the subject was why, as a Catholic and as a politician, you felt that you could support a woman's right to abortion even though the Catholic Church opposed it. Why, as a politician, you felt you didn't need to, that it would be inappropriate to do something because the Church said that this is what Catholics should do, that you needed to think of people who weren't Catholics, you know, to think of the larger public. What did the Church have to say in response to that speech? Did you get a reaction from either the Church you attended or from people more highly placed in the Church?
On the point that was most important to me, the Church spoke very carefully. Now, the most important thing for me was, theologically, can I be Roman Catholic, believe what I believe as a politician, you know, what appropriate political conduct is, and still be absolutely sound theologically? And articles appeared all across the United States, especially by the order priests, Jesuit priests, saying we've studied this. His theology is intact. This is theologically acceptable. It's theologically sound. Now, politically, the Church might want you to take a different position. Politically, they might say, look, it's better if you condemn abortion because that's our Church teaching. But there is no question that my position, which essentially was, look, I believe as a Catholic my conduct should proceed along certain lines. When it comes to abortion, it's largely irrelevant to me as a man, but my position should be abortion is wrong, period, and that's what I advise my daughters, that's why I advise my wife, etc., and if I'm a Catholic doctor, that creates certain obligations too. Incidentally, that's also true of contraceptives, the use of contraceptives. That is what I believe as a Catholic. You're not allowed to use artificial devices. The natural law, my Church teaches me that I cannot use contraceptives. I say, as a governor, I am not obliged to say to the people of the state of New York, you must not use contraceptives because I believe it is wrong to use contraceptives. You must not have divorce because I believe it is wrong to have divorce, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that was my position. Theologically, the Church's answer was, as far as I can tell, nobody from the hierarchy ever said he's wrong theologically. What they didn't like, what my own cardinal didn't like, Cardinal O'Connor, was that it appeared to many people I was differing with my church. I was not.
So when you were wrestling with this question over abortion and the church and your role as a governor, did this cause you great anguish, or were you just confident right from the get-go that...
No, it caused me great anguish. I wasn't sure I should do it. I wouldn't have done it if the archbishop, then later the cardinal, hadn't, in his first few weeks as archbishop of the Archdiocese of New York, come from Scranton, Pennsylvania, gone on a television show, and in answer to the question, do you think people like Mario Cuomo might be excommunicated from the church, paused, didn't reject that possibility, and allowed it, therefore, to fester in the minds of some, including my very youngest child, who happened to be watching at the time with me and Matilda, my wife, and that went through me like a dagger. And if it hadn't been for that, I never would have written the speech. I never would have spoken on the subject. It wasn't easy to do, and I did it with great, great reluctance and considerable trepidation.
Mario Cuomo has written a new book called Reason to Believe. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Mario Cuomo. The former governor of New York has written a new book called Reason to Believe. In your speeches and, you know, in talks with the public, you've often discussed your mother and the impact she had on you. I know she died last spring. She was from a poor village in Italy, an uneducated woman. Did she think education was important for you when you were growing up?
She couldn't read or write Italian. She couldn't read or write English. Papa couldn't read or write Italian. He learned a little English from Mr. Kessler, who put him in a grocery store in the Depression in South Jamaica, Queens. And, they lived and died for education. I bring in the report card to Papa in the grocery store behind the counter. He would look at the grades. A, 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 B. He'd get to the B, boom, it hit me with the back of his hand. He didn't know anything except B was not A, and B was not as good as A. He saved money in little bank books. Andrea Cuomo in trust for Franco Cuomo, my brother. Another book in trust for Maria, my sister. Another book in trust for Mario. And what was it for? You should go to school. He didn't know which school, how, what. He knew that really good schools cost money. And that's what the bank books were for. Not for him, not for a house, not for a new coat, not for a vacation. Just for education.
Were they surprised at the extent of your success?
Papa never lived to see it. Mama, I'll tell you a quick funny story about Mama. Papa and Mama thought it was wonderful when I graduated college. Law school, forget about it. Actually a lawyer, can you believe this? When I wrote a book in the 60s, my father, you know, he was showing people in the store the book. He couldn't read it, but he showed everybody. And, they were thrilled beyond words. When I became a politician, they were devastated. Why would you want to do this? You've been honest all your life, my father said. How can you be a politician? And they were crushed. So I had to tell them, look, I lost my first race, and they felt even worse. But then I went into government anyway, and I told them, Pa, I'm going to stay in politics because that's the way you get to be a judge. That was something he understood, judge, you know, that had dignity and that had security. He died before I ever won an election. I won election as governor. I'm standing on the platform with my mother, and the man goes to the mic and says, Mario Cuomo is the first Italian-American ever elected to a full term as governor of the state of New York. A lot of applause. I put my arm around Mama. I said, what do you think of your son now, Mom? She says, there's no bed, but when are you going to be judge? I'm not sure she ever thought I was a success.
You played on the Pittsburgh Pirates farm team briefly. How serious were you about becoming a player? Did you ever think you'd really become a baseball player?
No. This was another one of the lucky breaks in my life. I think the scouts saw me on some of my better days. Mickey Mantle only got $1,100 when he signed in 1949. Yogi Berra got $500. Joe Garagiola got $250. I got $2,000. And the scouting report described me as the best prospect in the Pittsburgh organization. With all of that, I didn't believe I'd do well. I went away. I did extremely well when I started. Then I got injured and came back from that. And then I got hit in the back of the head with a pitch, lost my eyesight, and was out of, and never played another baseball game for the rest of my life. They gave me a contract the next year, but the Pittsburgh Pirate doctors wouldn't let me play the next year because, you know, that was before MRIs and CAT scans. All they had was X-rays, and they'd see this black lump, this hematoma on the brain or whatever the mark was. And until that dissipated, unless they opened you up, which I wouldn't let them do, it wasn't safe to play, they thought. So I had a very short career, but a lot of fun, and used the $2,000 to buy Matilda a ring.
Did your parents want you to become an athlete?
No. My father said no to the contract when I first explained to him. I was underage, and he had to approve. And he said no because he asked some of the customers, and they said if he plays baseball, he won't finish college. And he explained that to me, and I explained it to the scout, who explained it to Branch Rickey, who was a lawyer and a genius, the man who brought Jackie Robinson into baseball, who brought us the first black player, and who was general manager of the Dodgers, then moved over to Pittsburgh. He wrote a beautiful letter to my father congratulating him and saying, you're right for wanting your son to get a college education, and I will stipulate in the contract he signs with us that he will never have to come to spring training or even to start the season until he finishes his college in the spring. And that's what happened. I went to DeLand on the Easter vacation, DeLand, Florida, for spring training, and didn't report to the team until the middle of May after I finished my semester at St. John's University.
Was it embarrassing to show up to the minor leagues with a letter from your father?
No, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to have to say to the scout, I know you want to give me $2,000, which is more money than I'll ever make, for playing ball, but my old man says that he doesn't want me to do it. That was really embarrassing, but it turned out very well. And Branch Rickey, I think, handled it very nicely.
Why did you decide to do the Doritos commercial with the former governor of Texas after you both lost last year?
That's a really interesting question. First of all, it produced some wonderful opportunities for us. You know, they give you money for those things, and if you have charities you're concerned about, you can do good things there, and sometimes you can use the money yourself too. But apart from that, if you watch that Doritos commercial again and listen to the words, we did most of the writing. And the one condition that Ann and I had is we don't want to sell product. We want a chance to make a statement. And the statement should be, okay, we lost, but we don't regret. We're not going to despair. We're not going to be bitter about it. We're not going to blame anybody for it. What we're going to say to America is, look, change can be good for you. And let's take a look at this and let's make the most of what we can. Most that we can with these new conditions. And that is exactly the sentence I use. I only have one sentence in it, really. And what I say to Ann is something like, look, Ann, you shouldn't feel that way. Change can be good for us. We ought to seize this opportunity to reconsider, and to go forward and to make the place better. And she says, I think you're right, Mario. And she picks up the Doritos bag and says, this is a new change bag of Doritos. I'm going to try it. So we thought it was fun, and that's the reaction we got from people.
Now that you have been out of office for a year, are you ever sorry that you refused the Supreme Court seat or decided not to enter the presidential race?
No. At the time I made those judgments, I think they were the best judgments I could have made. I made them honestly, sincerely, and whether they're right, wrong, doesn't matter much. But I thought them through, and I don't have any regrets.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Mario Cuomo has written a new book called Reason to Believe. This is Fresh Air.